In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened.
We are a nation generated by ideas, the beneficiaries of people who took terrific risks and who were a fount, if you will, of originality and ingenuity.
So if people have views that you find offensive, we can either silence them so that nobody challenges us for 4 years, or we can welcome them, debate with them, and try to hash it out and make us all smarter.
So I love what we've been talking about up to this point, and I think it's very good philosophical view. It is why we have our Costco brand Neuhaus and David and our Costco brand Dreyer and Austin here, because this is the kind of conversation I wanted. But dragging it back to the light treason, as we knew we must, you know, we've talked about who's to blame here. And in the grand scheme of things, I think we've talked about some good things with, you know, the religious right refusing to take responsibility for the fact that you elected a man who thinks ethics are optional. And we can talk about the specific ways in which, you know, Trump's rhetoric, even though he didn't technically incite the violence, what the hell else did he think was going to happen? What the hell did Giuliani think was going to happen when he says things like trial by combat? But once the event had occurred, once the light treason was well underway, I had been in a meeting and I got a call from a friend right after the meeting, and he's like, "Are you watching the news?" And I'm like, "No, I'm, you know, working." And he's like, "You need to watch the news." And I turned it on. And I'm like, "Good Lord. I see some guy in a buffalo wig or whatever the hell it was, is in the Capitol building. The senators are all underground. It's insane." And now that we've, you know, that event didn't take, honestly, in the grand scheme of things, it was over relatively quickly. While it was happening and towards the end of it happening, there were certain things said, and then afterwards there were other things said in terms of condemning the violence. Everyone now likes to say, well, Trump condemned the violence. He said, "I condemn this." And certainly after it became quite clear that it was that he was going to potentially be impeached over this, he condemned the violence.
And lose his social media accounts.
Well, yes. That was when he started condemning the violence. But he also condemned it the day of, and I think this goes kind of back to that issue of his culpability, because everyone's saying, "Oh no, he's always been anti-violence. The right is anti-violence. Violence is a left-wing problem." And, you know, Trump and Cruz and Hawley, they all condemned the violence. You know, it's all the left who wants to blame this on them.
Yeah, it wasn't a member of the left who killed a police officer by bashing his head with a fire extinguisher.
Oh, I'd also like to read what Donald Trump pre-recorded and put on his Twitter, because his Twitter is gone now, and we'll talk about that. But I'd like to read a dramatic reading of his video, because it's harder to find. "I know your pain. I know you're hurt. We had an election that was stolen from us. It was a landslide election, and everyone knows it, especially the other side. But you have to go home now. We have to have peace. We have to have law and order. We have to respect our great people in law and order. We don't want anybody hurt. It's a very tough period of time. There's never been a time like this where such a thing happened, where they could take it away from all of us, from me, from you, from our country. This was a fraudulent election. But we can't play into the hands of these people. We have to have peace. So go home. We love you. You're very special. We've seen what happens. You see the way others are treated that are so bad and so evil. I know how you feel. But go home and go home in peace." End quote. First of all, we wouldn't take it seriously if it were a parent saying this to their kid destroying the candy aisle. We would say that they weren't a disciplined parent, and we'd get mad at them. As far as Trump condemning violence, that being held, it's like, oh, he's not talking to the people rioting. He's talking to the mostly peaceful protest. And we'll come back to mostly peaceful protest, because it's a thing. But I think the idea that you can take him seriously as condemning the violence, or any of these people as taking it seriously as condemning the violence for what they did on the day, I find that laughable. I think, again, it goes back to what we talked about, where it's like, he absolutely did. What did he think was going to happen? "You have valid grievances, but please stop storming the castle." Like, what the hell did he think was going to go on there?
Yeah, it was not a sincere condemnation, which starts off with "the election was stolen." It doesn't help when you start your call to go home by reinforcing and restating the reason everyone's there doing what they're doing. That is not putting out the fire. that is standing there with a water bucket in one hand, pretending you're going to put out the fire, and throwing a Molotov cocktail on it with the other.
Yeah, I think that's exactly spot on. And, you know, I think that the coddling is what's so shameful about that response, right? It's this idea of, you know, you have to massage their egos and, you know, basically, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod. Yeah, well, I have to tell you to go home, but, you know, we all know the reason why you're there is a valid one. And, you know, it's okay that you're out there, you know, storming into the Capitol because I love you and I care about you. I mean, it's just, it's absurd.
To me, to interpret that as anything but coddling is to have an agenda. We can go back to what I said about the parents. We can just go back to the plain facts of the matter. You don't say, I love you when someone's blowing up the Capitol. And this kind of goes into the next thing I want to bring up, because I think the two are so linked, and that is the whataboutism that has defined the societal discussion about this. There's so much whataboutism. You know, we had a summer with a lot of riots. We've had 4 years where some people, not all, some people on the left have said that Trump was a Russian plant and they've objected to the election, ergo this is all fine. Which, at least the way my parents raised me, two wrongs don't make a right. So even granting all of this, why does this justify everything? I don't like whataboutism. It's lazy rhetoric. But I also think that there's something special about this, especially if we're going to take the big claim that they make, which is, you know, comparing this to the BLM-related riots over the summer. Again, first of all, and I will say in both cases, even though there are a lot of differences that we're just going to stick with the argument, ignore. In both cases, a small percentage of a peaceful protest turned violent. I would say there are fundamental differences in why they were protesting, but we'll leave that aside for now. We'll grant it. But in the case of, you know, BLM, Black Lives Matter rallies going on in the summer, we have video of it, right? African-American protesters screaming at the agitators saying, please stop throwing Molotov cocktails. Stop fighting. We're here to peacefully protest. They're trying to embody the civil rights movement while mostly white middle-class liberals decide that they can make things better by sacking a Saks Fifth Avenue or what have you. I think you have a very clear delineation. But let's say that's not a difference you want to go on. Okay. In the BLM rallies, the cops immediately come out with pepper spray and a lot of violence. And while there was some of that with the DC riots, we also have some really disturbing videos of the cops letting the rioters in and taking selfies with them. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's, like, documented. You can find the video. And I think the really fundamental difference is that even though, like, and again, I don't think this is that controversial. Plenty of people very much on the left wing have already said, we condemn the riots, but can you please pay attention to the underlying cause? With BLM, the underlying cause of the deep-seated need for criminal justice reform had largely gone unaddressed. It's still largely unaddressed. Massachusetts just on New Year's Eve passed something with the remarkable, you know, they're being praised for this, and I guess they should be because it's incremental good. But like just the idea that, oh yeah, if cops violate your rights, they should probably be fired. You know, this is such a novel idea. Beautiful, beautiful. I'm glad you can be so forward-thinking. Whereas, you know, with the cause of the DC rioters, you had been heard. You had been heard over 60 different times in front of 60 different courts, many of them with Trump's own appointees saying, what the hell is wrong with you? Get out of my courtroom. You know, we go back and see the episode right before Christmas if you want to hear us go over more over that. So for me, this whataboutism, it's not an argument. I find it deeply offensive as somebody whose big cause is criminal justice reform. I'm like, okay, so some riots occurred around criminal justice reform and some riots occurred around this, but that does not make the underlying causes equivalent. It just doesn't. That's like saying, okay, well, the U.S. has committed war crimes and Saudi Arabia has committed war crimes. Ergo, every single war that both countries have been involved in are completely the same. U.S. has never been the good guy. You know, is that the logic you want to use? I think this is an attempt by people on the right to basically try to say, well, I know you are, but what am I? And I have no patience for it. But I'm interested to hear what you guys think.
There's a lot to unpack with it. Because one of the first things I think of is, okay, when other people attack law enforcement, they need to just, you know, shut up and comply. Just do what the officer tells you and everything will be fine. And back the blue and, you know, acting out against police officers is never acceptable. Just, you know, comply and fight it in court. But like I said earlier, we get to bash a police officer over the head with a fire extinguisher so he walks back to his office, collapses, and dies in the hospital. We get to push past police lines and bully police and get in physical altercations with them to get to go and do what we want because, well, that rule doesn't apply to us, apparently. And I hate to be too cynical about it, but it doesn't apply to us because, well, you know, we back law enforcement otherwise, and oh, right, we're white. That's part of it. That's part of the problem with the whole back the blue thing the whole time is that it's always been a double standard of you back the blue and you have to respect law enforcement when we say that's what you do. But the American Revolution was fine. That was totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. We're not going to look at how back the blue is kind of the same thing as back the red in the context of 1776. It's always been a double standard, and this is just a perfect example of that, of the rules never apply to everybody equally. Yet no shit. That's part of the problem with the whole criminal justice reform movement anyway. And yeah, no swearing rule, whatever. But I'm really fed up with that whole line of argument. So part of it is the problem with that double standard of back the blue existing in the first place. Beyond that double standard, the next part is talking directly about the comparison between BLM and this. Well, one big difference is that the violent bad actors at BLM rallies were not acting at the behest of an American politician. That's a big difference. It's also a big difference in that it wasn't the U.S. Capitol. And I think, Aaron, this is something you said to me earlier, so I'm stealing your language. It is not a difference of degree. It is a difference of kind. Again, it goes back to what I said about the question of, was this a coup? You're not looting a storefront. As bad as that might be, you're interrupting a democratic process of trying to facilitate the peaceful transfer of power in a constitutional republic. That's a different thing. It just is. There's even actual level of violence aside, there's a huge difference in the fact that what you did had so much symbolic meaning. You invaded the house where our democratically elected representatives do the work of representing us and deciding the governance of this country. You interrupted them doing their jobs that they were elected to do by your fellow Americans because you disagree with the results of a free and fair election. You did that in this place that has always been the seat of our government and probably one of the most important national symbols of what our constitutional republic stands for. That is a completely different thing, and to pretend otherwise is ridiculous because symbolism matters. Icons matter. And to make a distinction, I'm talking even secular ones matter. This says something to people, to everyone. This communicates something totally different than generic property violence. It's not generic property violence when it's against the U.S. Capitol any more than it would be generic property violence if you burned the Declaration of Independence or tore up the Mona Lisa. Objects, symbols, and physical objects carry meaning beyond just their physical presence. And to say otherwise is to be an iconoclast to an extent that it doesn't even make sense. So saying that this is the same thing as the worst parts of what happened during the summer just doesn't work on multiple levels. There's probably more that I haven't thought of, but I'll go ahead and leave it there so that David can get his piece.
Well, before David does, because I'm interested in hearing David's opinion on this as well, and I'm interested in hearing both of your opinions on this, actually. Austin and I have talked on the podcast before about Lou Rockwell and how I am not fond of him, to put it mildly. He's been affiliated with Ron Paul. He's affiliated with the Mises Institute. He is a notorious anti-Semite, a notorious conspiracy theorist. And whereas I kind of got into libertarianism several years ago because I thought it was all about respecting individual liberty and respecting individuals' rights to do things, his view seems to be, you are at liberty to do what I want you to do. If not, great violence can be done to you. I do not have a lot of time for Lou Rockwell or his ilk. But Lou Rockwell has been very fond, and his ilk, in the, you know, disaffected conservative / libertarian group of the internet, have been very active in talking about, well, yeah, it was the Capitol. It's state property, which means it's our property. We have the right to do whatever we want on it. This tragedy of the commons, Meshugas, and I want to hear, I'm sure, Austin, you have a very simple, that is stupid answer, but I want that to be part of the ethos before David gets to answer, just because I think it's a genuine argument people are using, and I probably should have led with it.
Yeah, it kind of belongs to all of us, but each individual's interest in that is approximately one out of 300 million, one 300 millionth. Your one 300 millionth interest does not outweigh the rest of us. If you want to view this as a libertarian mutual or collective ownership thing, then it works like a corporation and you got outvoted. Yeah, this collective ownership thing doesn't make any sense. You don't get a veto over everybody else's opinion of how the thing should be used. That's why the rotunda isn't a bouncy ball pit.
Well, it could be, and it would be better.
It could be, and I guarantee you there's somebody out there who thinks it should be.
Yes, me.
Like you.
Sorry, David, you were going.
Well, I was going to say, you kind of see the same level of thinking, though, in that, you know, viral video where the lady corners Mitt Romney at the airport, right? And the rationale was the same thing as the people saying, well, this is, you know, Congress belongs to the people, therefore it's not as bad as storming, you know, Target, because Target doesn't belong to everyone, but Congress does, right? You know, when she corners him and is berating him about, you know, his support of, you know, President Trump, you know, her rationale is, I voted for you, therefore this gives me ownership over you. The point is, there's a difference between property that belongs to the people, broadly defined in terms of federal buildings, versus property that belongs to, you know, one individual who runs, you know, their local, you know, Target or Walmart or whatever the case is. But that same level of thinking of, well, I voted, therefore this is mine, and I can define the rules how I want to define them.
Also, this train of logic leads to the absurd conclusion that I can loot every Target in the country if I want to, if I just buy one share of their stock. I can pay for one share of their stock by looting, you know, we're talking about a lot of TVs, man. I can do that. I can make that math work.
So moving on to some of the consequences of this, and obviously there we'll be talking about, you know, finally how to deal with it. But one big consequence of it has been that President Trump's phone has been bricked, essentially. He's been given a lifetime Twitter ban. His Facebook has been taken away until after the inauguration of President Biden. And, you know, again, there's kind of this public good argument that people are saying, oh, this is the end of free speech. And the idea that these are private corporations and they have the right to do this, like, well, no, because without them, you can't have a public sphere. And I'm like, okay, well, that's always been true. Not many people owned their own printing presses in the 18th century. The printer could say, no, I am not publishing your pamphlet as to why we should all eat rats for our spiritual good. I think it is insane and unworthy of being distributed in these here colonies. And it's the same now, like people are banning Trump, and people are outraged over this. They're outraged that Parler has been taken out of app stores because it was used to help plan these riots, and it's being used to help plan subsequent riots on the 17th and on Inauguration Day. People are saying that this is not a natural consequence. We should have a free and open discussion of ideas, and that this is authoritarian to ban Trump from these social media happenings, and this is not a valid consequence at all, and I mean, obviously, in some ways, this could all be its own episode, but we've talked about free speech so often. I wonder that if in the context of the aftermath of these riots and the pre-math, or whatever you'd call it, of these other planned riots about this. I'm sorry, planned peaceful demonstrations that have absolutely no chance of going off the rails, that people are planning for the upcoming week and beyond. How does that free speech stuff strike you?
There's a certain point where somebody keeps coming in, and to tie it back around to before, you know, shouting fire in the movie theater, it might be time to ban him from the movie theater.
It's also, is to an extent, on the one hand, it's really complicated, and I'll get into that, but in another way, it's very simple. Private companies aren't controlled by the United States Constitution, and I don't know why we have to explain this to, among other people, a United States senator.
Well, Josh Hawley knows better than that. He knows better than that. He clerked for the Supreme Court. He understands this stuff. I mean, it's kind of...
I'm not convinced.
It seems, to me at least, it just seems like he's being super duper disingenuous and using, like, you know, a popular conception of what the First Amendment is in order to, you know, justify why he had his book deal taken away. You know, I mean...
I also wouldn't put him above that, I guess.
Right. That's what I mean. It's, you know, under the loosest definition of the First Amendment, I think you would struggle to find a right to a book deal with Simon and Schuster in there, but this is just him throwing red meat to his base. But this is what frustrates me, is that even as absurd as that argument is, we have to take it seriously because people have very serious feelings about this and they're emotionally distraught over the outcome of the election, which, I mean, at a certain point, you know, give me a break. I mean, to tie it back into what we were talking about before with, you know, the riots that happened over the summer and then the riots that happened now, you would find nobody on the right saying, well, we need to take these arguments seriously, if not literally, because, you know, the emotion that's at stake. But suddenly when it serves their purposes, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, you know, pundits on the right are more than happy to suddenly, you know, say we need to take things seriously, but not literally, because of how, you know, upset and how much of a tantrum people want to throw. Sorry, was that too spicy?
No, that's totally fair. And again, I think we should probably say for the end the fact that there are, you know, not illegitimate concerns at the base of all these things that, you know, were at the base of Trump getting elected in the first place. But as far as the Twitter, Facebook thing, on the one hand, it is that simple that they're not controlled by the U.S. Constitution. You have no First Amendment right to other people giving your voice amplification. You only have First Amendment right to the government not censoring your speech. But on the other hand, you know, even people on the left are pointing out that there is a concern with what Twitter and Facebook are doing, in that if this idea were taken farther, it would go places we don't like, because they are so foundational to people having the ability to speak in the society we have now. I mean, I forget what the stats were. It was like 22% of United States adults use Twitter and 3/4 of them use Facebook. We're talking about real impacts to your ability to reach other people with what you're saying. And the concern is that if either of those platforms started really seriously taking sides and playing for one team or the other, you could have some real problems. And I don't think that's illegitimate. I don't think that isn't a concern. I think there's an argument that eventually, at some point, that I don't know quite exactly how to identify, Twitter and Facebook reach the level of a public utility, because there would be a problem, for example, if all of the cell phone services in an area conspire to say, nope, none of us are serving you because we don't like you, because that is so important to functioning in today's society. They aren't there yet, but I don't want to say this is so simple as to just dismiss that concern out of hand. There is a real chilling effect on speech, so to speak, concern here. And I think it's something to keep an eye on in the future. That said, I don't think that specifically Trump being deplatformed is, you know, the last brick in the wall falling before we all live in a privately enforced totalitarian state.
Right. But I what I find kind of absurd about the argument that's being made is that, you know, it tends to be coming from the right wing currently, and gone are their free market principles that, you know, again, you can find Josh Hawley, when he was, you know, attorney general running for Senate, campaigning on. You know, suddenly it's that we have to basically classify Twitter and Facebook as public utilities, which is certainly a level of government intervention in the market that I don't think that you've necessarily seen a lot of people in the Republican Party advocating for, at least in recent memory. So it's this idea of, like, you know, well, we can't possibly be okay with there being kind of different options, right? So we can't be okay with, you know, we don't like the politics of Apple, so we're going to leave for a different phone provider, right? And a different app store so we can get access to Parler. Or we can't be okay with just leaving Twitter and Facebook for MeWe or Parler or whatever the case is, right? Instead, we've got to basically, like, stamp our feet and say, I demand I be platformed on this thing which I don't own, which I just find a very strange argument, especially when you listen to the rationale of Twitter, Facebook, etc., where they are concerned with public safety going forward, right? Like, I don't know of a whole lot of people who, when 4chan was hosting some very seedy, dangerous stuff, you know, were in the Senate kind of saying that we somehow need to take a stand against, you know, big tech censoring 4chan forums. You know what I mean? It just seems to be politically expedient for the parties involved to have, or rather, it seems politically expedient for the parties involved to have an easy kind of whipping boy in Twitter, Facebook. You know, I mean, for goodness sakes, Josh Hawley's book was even titled The Tyranny of Big Tech, right? It's very low-level argumentation being made for the sake of one's political career. So I think maybe in terms of what you're saying, maybe there is an argument to be made in terms of the public utility of these websites, but I don't think that's what's going on here, if that makes sense.
No, I think you're right because... You know, you talk about political expediency. Trump's been talking about as if like he was the only bastion standing against socialism. And okay, sure, if he wants to say as opposed to Marxist socialism, then what he's advocating is and his supporters are advocating may not count as socialism. But in terms of socialism more broadly defined within political psychology and political science, state ownership of and management and total regulation of industry. The argument being advanced is, well, people need Facebook and Twitter, and if without Facebook and Twitter, they don't have a worldview, which, as Austin says, could be true in the future. Currently, right now, it's not quite to that point. But they're saying, well, because he wants it badly enough and he needs it, he has a right to it. We have a right to it. And I'm like, okay, but when Obama said he was going to give people phones, which even that was just blown wildly out of proportion, people absolutely pitched a hissy fit. When people say healthcare is a right, you absolutely pitch a hissy fit. But all of a sudden, Twitter's all right, but healthcare isn't. And I'm not taking a stance on either side here. I'm just saying, for the love of all that is holy, please be consistent. Because right now, you're just doing it because of political expediency.
Yeah, it's completely hypocritical. I agree with that. I'm just saying that it would be unwise to dismiss the idea that this could be a problem entirely simply based on who's talking about it now and why.
No, and I get that, and I do think there's stuff to worry about tech in general beyond the political sphere. You know, there's good things and there's bad things. Tech is a blessing and a curse. Like any technological innovation, it has its good side and its bad side. But for me, you know, especially in the light of other events, you know, we had the 5G bombing. It's been such a news blizzard that's kind of fallen by the wayside. But in Tennessee a few weeks ago, a guy blew up an AT&T plant because he thought 5G was actually causing cancer and all this stuff. This absurd crap has been allowed to just been spread without any moderation. And Trump is pushing objectively, and this goes back to the previous point, you know, BLM and the idea of reform wasn't entering the courts. Trump's been given his time in court, and they've said no. And people are unhappy about that. And he keeps pushing these insane conspiracy theories that quite blatantly call for violent action. So for me, it's like, okay, conspiracy theories are killing people. You know, the same way if somebody, you know, if I'm very open to free discussion of ideas in any classroom I have. I'm totally open for free discussion of ideas, even if I disagree with them. But I did once have to tell someone that they would that if they didn't shut up, they'd be thrown out of my classroom. I said it kindly and nicely because they brought up the idea that, well, what about race and IQ? You know, some races are smarter than others. And I'm like, that is patently untrue. That is patently untrue, blatantly untrue. And we are not talking about that in this classroom. We're going to talk after class. And it's not like I'm trying to stifle his free speech. He didn't get expelled or anything like that. But he got us talking to him like, this is not acceptable to express at OU. This is not acceptable to express in a classroom. And he got told point blank, you ever express that in my classroom again, I'm cutting you from my class. I'm not letting my minority students feel threatened because you as a white male want to come in and say, yeah, well, black people are stupid because I saw it once. Not happening. Not acceptable. I don't see why Twitter and Facebook don't have the right to say, okay, his BS rhetoric caused a friggin' riot that went to the Capitol building. He's done. We're not letting that happen again. And the big defense I've seen came from his son, Donald Trump Jr., who even said, like, you know, well, they still let the Ayatollah have an audience, so that these other people say hateful things. And I'm like, yeah, you raise a very good point. I think they should shut them down, too. I think absolutely if Twitter wants to say, yeah, no calling for genocide against minorities, you say something like, you know, you say something homophobic, you're off the platform. I'm like, you don't like it? Don't use the platform. Sucks to be you. I don't think the solution is, well, they're letting these other people get away with it. They should let me get away with it, too. I'm like, no, they shouldn't let you get away with it, and they shouldn't let other people get away with it. Thank you for pointing that out.
This is a complicated issue because there is a slippery slope here. And I'll fully acknowledge, yeah, there is a slippery slope. you can't stay off of it though, because, you know, like your classroom thing is a great example of the power you wielded there could be used in incredibly detrimental ways, because it could shut down legitimate discussion of things that really should be talked about and that people should, in context in which people should work past their disagreement and respectfully engage people who have a difference of opinion. There's a bunch of gray area here. Twitter could take this too far and go past Trump and the Ayatollah and go to just anybody expressing a relatively iodine conservative view. Well, we don't like that, so we're going to get rid of that, and we're going to make up this reason for why it's dangerous. And I think that's what people are worried about. But to an extent, that slippery slope can't be avoided, and people are going to have to learn how to wield this power responsibly. And that's just a fact. This isn't a cut and dry issue. You can't just avoid this problem. So I think the concerns are justified, but you can't just create a situation where they cease to exist. This is going to be something we have to deal with going forward on an ongoing basis with social media of, you know, there's a line between organizing a violent pogrom and expressing your opinion of a political candidate in completely respectful terms. There's a spectrum between those two, and we're going to have to find where in that spectrum it stops being one thing and starts being another. And that's incredibly hard. It involves a lot of subjective calls. And that's just how it is. I don't see how you avoid that.
As I kind of thought about, you know, the idea of platform in general, right? I mean, you have a platform. The president had a platform. But yeah, you have to be able to use this responsibly, because you can't hide behind the First Amendment, which is, again, not about a private entity. It's about, you know, again, freedom of you know, persecution based on one's speech from the government, right? So that's kind of a misapplication of that idea. But the idea that you have to be able to use your platform responsibly, otherwise you risk losing the platform. You have the right to speech, you don't have the right to a particular platform. And I think I've seen this in church work quite a bit. And to kind of pivot a little bit, we've seen very high profile former kind of megachurch pastors, right? They all conflate this idea of, well, I have grace, right? I am forgiven. Therefore, I deserve my platform back, right? And it's an ignoring of the fact that there are legitimate repercussions when you misuse your platform. Again, you don't have a right to a particular audience. You have a right to speak your mind, but maybe we're not going to put you back as a pastor. And to, again, use that analogy with Twitter, you have a right to say what you want to say. Great. But we don't have to amplify it and project it on Twitter, because you have to demonstrate some degree of responsibility in using this platform.
Well, speaking of consequences, and obviously we've had a lengthy discussion over these couple of episodes over this, but the consequences of what happened are still being decided. This is, again, we're recording this on the 10th, maybe by the 12th. There'll be some resolving on this, but articles of impeachment have been advanced. There is serious talk about using the 25th Amendment to take Trump out of power for the rest of his term until inauguration day, 10 days from when we record this. There is talk about impeaching him and impeaching him out of office so that he can't run for office again. And there are cases being made on both sides of the aisle. Some people saying, well, if you impeach him, it would be great if he couldn't run again, but what if he wins again? You've empowered him. Some people saying, well, this isn't really an impeachable offense because he didn't necessarily do anything criminal. There seems to be some genuine disagreement as to what you can and can't impeach someone for. What do we think about impeach? Do you think that he deserves to be impeached? Do you think that there should be a support for impeachment efforts? Should we just remove him from office using the 25th Amendment? What do we do moving forward with Donald Trump? Do you think it's worth impeaching him? Do you think it's removing him from office? Where do we go from here, man?
I'm personally kind of surprised there aren't more Republicans who, and maybe they're expressing this privately because they're afraid of backlash from voters. I would think there'd be more Republicans who want him impeached because it would mean they didn't have to deal with him in 2024. You don't have him coming in the primaries and ripping your party apart again, so we can do this all over. I would think that would be a more attractive option, and maybe it is, and they're, you know, people are just trying to figure out, okay, which of us has to bite the bullet and actually vote for this to make it happen while the rest of us can formally oppose it and reap the benefits. Maybe that's the kind of calculus that's going on. I don't know. I still think that, for one thing, the 25th Amendment route's kind of gone out the window because, from all appearances, it looks like we don't have enough people in the cabinet who would support it, so it's just not going to happen. As far as impeachment goes, I think he should be impeached because I think these are impeachable offenses, and I think there needs to be a bright line in the sand that says we are not proto-fascist Italy or Germany, and physical invasions of federal government buildings to interrupt Republican processes by elected officials isn't acceptable. Red line in the sand. This isn't okay. You don't get to do this without consequences. As much as that shouldn't be something that has to be said, I think now it does have to be said because it happened. So I think if for nothing else than that message, it's important to impeach him, or at least try to, because it's just like with Nixon. We have to show clearly what you did here is not okay, and this will not be tolerated from the next person who does it. I think it's as simple as that.
No, I mean, we've had plenty of discussions up to this point. And honestly, that to me, that's where I'm at, too, is it's kind of like, yes, impeach him. Our allies the world over, there was even an article to this extent. Like, they've had people talking to the media saying, oh, yeah, no, we think this was a coup. We think he was cooperating. And, you know, everyone wants to talk about the goods of the Trump presidency. Look at the deregulation he accomplished. Look at X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, okay, I had a professor in college. He was a very conservative gentleman. He was a history professor. And he always would talk about Nixon when we covered the 70s in American history. He's like, Nixon did a lot of good. Nixon opened up trade with China. No one else had been able to do that. But Nixon's legacy is Watergate, and he deserves it. Because when you cross certain lines, you don't get to say, but he was good about X, Y, and Z. You know, at the end of the day, he did this. I don't care if the pecan pies of the antebellum South, well, one, I don't because I'm allergic to nuts. Let's say these pies were the most wonderful things you'd ever tasted in your life. Okay, cool. Cool. You still own people. Like, it doesn't matter. I don't, you know, people want to talk about, oh, the glories of such and such thing in the past. I'm like, okay, cool, but we don't get to ignore the bad just because there was good. And sometimes the good does genuinely outweigh the bad. But when the bad is, whether through malfeasance or incompetence, causing a coup at the Capitol building, you need to never hold office again. And I do think that they should impeach him for it. I do think he should never be allowed to hold office again because Trumpism cannot be allowed. I don't think it should be allowed to continue in the country. And I don't mean that in the terms of a legal thing as much as I do just a civic virtue thing. It has to be not tolerated. Especially right. Looking at the people who showed up at this march, like, you know, Camp Auschwitz t-shirts, white power symbols, the Confederate battle flag right. That is a white supremacist symbol. If that doesn't paint it really clearly for you what this sort of rhetoric attracts, it's worth condemning. And it's a civic virtue idea. And so for me, yeah, impeach him. Get him out of there.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it would actually work. I mean, I have no idea whether or not, you know, they could get the votes to actually convict in the Senate. But I think it's worth weighing the option just because, you know, barring him from holding federal office again would do, in my mind, a lot to promote at least a little bit of healing in the country so we can sort of move on from this moment of, you know, intense kind of just political anger, you know, toward one another. And certainly, you know, at the hands of someone who's been, you know, kind of stoking the flames of that. So if we can at least move on, I don't think that alone would fix the country's problems. I don't think that alone would fix our issues of political polarization, but I think it would be a step in the right direction so we can start to turn the page on this particular moment. But again, you have no idea what party operatives are going to do as far as their own self-interest and you know, how they might vote on something like that.
I think it's important to force him to do it, though. I think that if nothing else, even if he's not convicted in the Senate, you've got a list of names of who voted which way. I think that, frankly, the Republican Party, for enabling Trump in the way that they have, they kind of deserve that. And I'm not going to feel sorry for any Republican senator who has to sit there and agonize over what to do because they're too worried about votes. I think this is a trial, not like the trial in the Senate, but like for what each of these senators would experience. I think it's something they deserved. And it's a test that they've completely brought on themselves. And aside from that, I think practically speaking, it's not dead on arrival in the Senate. It could very well happen. We've already got Murkowski has said that she would vote yes. Sasse has said he'd consider it. I think Mitt Romney would vote yes. I mean, he did last time. I think McConnell is a possibility. Suzanne Collins is absolutely a possibility.
I think Pat Toomey.
Probably missing Toomey is a possibility. So we're already counting a significant way upwards to the required 17 that would have to flip to convict.
Plus, Lindsey Graham did do the equivalent of break up with his girlfriend via text when he said that his love affair with Trump is over. So, you
know. Yeah. So he's possible too. I think it could happen. I think it could happen. There's enough of a possibility it could happen that even aside from it's worth doing if you lose, it's also worth trying because you might win.
Yeah, I agree, though I absolutely do not believe that Lindsey Graham meant it at all.
And that's fair. That's why I'm saying let's put it through the Senate, make them do the trial, and make them put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah.
Did you really mean that? Let's find out.
To Austin's point, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Wayne Gretzky, Michael Scott.
Oy vey. All right, well, we opened with the office's old-fashioned cocktail recipe. We may as well close with the office's fine example of how plagiarism works.
Before we end, one thing that does need to be part of everyone's conversation going forward, I've meant to bring this up this whole time, so I'm going to get it in before we wrap up. Well, David, one of your things about political division in this country, it's not going away because Trump goes away, because as much as the left have tried to lay the intensive political division in this country at Trump's feet, he's not the only one to blame. He might be the most prominent person to blame. He might even have more blame than any other individual person in the entire country. I'll buy that. It's not, this problem isn't ending after we get rid of Trump, because Trump's voters aren't going anywhere. And people voted for Trump for a reason. Okay, yeah, some of them voted for him because they're the kind of people who wear Camp Auschwitz shirts. I'm going to say that's really not most of them, as much as some really tone-deaf people on the left might like to pretend that it is, that we can just dismiss all these people as deplorables and say, we're just going to steamroll these people because, and this is something I've griped about before, political power is all that matters, and we're just going to gain power and exercise it, and we can just never deal with these people again as long as we can keep outvoting them. You can't. They remain a political force in this country, and as we've kept kind of obliquely mentioning throughout the episode, there are legitimate gripes. Working class white people voted for Trump in droves, and they have been left behind in this economy in some very serious ways. And since we've been talking about BLM this whole time, no, it doesn't compare to what people of color have to deal with in this country. The way I would put it is that there are systemic problems in both, but systemic racism means the entire system, all the systems together, are against you. That's not to say that there are not some specific systems that are very actively working against, for example, coal miners or iron workers in Pennsylvania, the rest of the Rust Belt. There are legitimate gripes here, and we don't move past this by ignoring them. Because that's just to tell someone, well, your needs are not as important as this other person's needs, or because your disadvantages or sufferings are not as great as this person's, they don't matter at all. That's not true. To use a great example to show, like, a lot of what BLM movement calls for and a lot of what we're calling for, and when we talk about criminal justice, would help these people as well. There's a lot of overlap, even though the gripes and the sufferings and the disadvantages are not equivalent. For example, if we fixed the bail bond system in one of the many ways we could do that, that's going to help everybody. Being poor and white in the criminal justice system is not as bad as being poor and black by a long shot. It still means you can't pay your bail. So that's just one example of fixing this would help everybody. We need to identify where we can actually help these people, because they're still American citizens who deserve beneficial, helpful treatment from their government and from their fellow citizens. So getting rid of Trump doesn't fix those problems. Getting rid of Trump doesn't get rid of his supporters. And I think it'd be a mistake to dismiss all of them by saying that the people who invaded the Capitol represent them, just as much as it would be a mistake to say that some urban, middle-class, white, liberal douchebag who burned down a Starbucks represents Black Lives Matter. Which I know you guys agree with that, but that's just something that's been bothering me, because we've been griping about the right a lot, but that doesn't mean I don't have gripes with the left. And the way they want to, many people on the left want to just dismiss Trump voters is a problem, in that it's just going to mean we do this again in more and worse ways down the road. And that's, again, not everybody on the left. There are plenty of people who are trying to get at the root of why did people vote for Trump. I think it matters that a lot of people who voted for Trump also voted for Obama. There's some clues there, but that needs to be part of the conversation going forward. To, again, get back to David's point of you're not going to heal the political divisions in this country by writing off half the people engaged in them.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, just in terms of, you know, if I want to do a little like self-plug, right, if the church wants to help with this idea, right, of fixing some political divisions in the country, right, obviously we can't write off, you know, a whole swath of voters, whether that's Trump voters, whether that's Biden voters, whether that's Bernie voters, you know, whatever the case is, right? I think what we need to do is, you know, be comfortable with listening to points of view that we might not agree with, and maybe we're never going to come to a consensus on, but we can still, you know, hear them out as our neighbor first and foremost. And I think that's something that the church has contributed to, you know, in at varying degrees of success, right, throughout church history. But in terms of welcoming a stranger in our midst and hearing him out, even if it, you know, might go against what we normally would think or feel on an issue, if only because it helps to, we could say, create a greater degree of at least compassion toward those who we would normally disagree with and have issues with. And again, that idea of compassion itself, you know, compassion towards people who we have legitimate divisions with, right? That compassion being a virtue and an end even in and of itself, I think is something worth striving towards.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point to raise, especially at the end of these episodes, because I think honestly the best I've ever heard about this came from somebody on the left. Her name is Professor Loretta Ross, and she talks about her entire system is basically how we do diversity training at OU, and she talks about calling in instead of calling out. Calling out someone and saying, you sexist piece of garbage, you homophobic piece of trash, you racist jerkwad, and instead going, what do you think somebody from such and such a group would think about what you just said? Are you okay with the fact that what you just said is horrifying? Do you not see, you know, trying to get them to perspective take, to say things like, you know, okay, you say things like, all black people are, you know, they're responsible for their own problems and with the criminal justice system. But you're a poor white person and you've had problems with the criminal justice system. Can it enter your head that it might be worse for a black person? And not saying it to shame them, but to try to get them to take a perspective and be empathetic. Not just trying to get them to be empathetic either, but being empathetic to them. And not making it all about shame and punishment of people who disagree with us, but instead trying to gain connection to them, to empathize with them, and really move forward together. And you know, it sucks when you remember, and I say this with very minimal experience of it compared to somebody like Professor Ross, who is African-American, but it's still, you know, it's something that anyone from a marginalized group, Jewish, LGBTQ, African-American, has at least some experience with of like, you can choose to get angry. It's your right to get angry. I think it's our right to get angry at Trump voters and how they've acted. I think it has absolutely our right to get angry. But do we want to have a culture that survives and a country that survives? Or do we actually want to move on from this? Because he did draw more numbers than any president before him. It's just that the guy who beat him drew more numbers than he did. So, yeah, the problem is not going away with Trump. And I think we need to take a step back and think about how we relate to people on both sides of the political spectrum. Though perhaps we say it as should not, considering how much we've been yelling at Trump this episode. But, you know. Well, I'd like to say this will be the last time we'll talk about Trump as president, but last week taught me to never say something like that again, and I will never say something like that again. So for all we know, he sets up some sort of Avignon presidency and becomes the president in exile from Mar-a-Lago, and this becomes a confusing 4 years where everyone goes, who was the president again in like 100 years? Who's to say? Obviously, as always, if you have any questions or comments or thoughts or feelings, you can feel free to reach out to us at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com. We will be back next week. Take care, guys. This has been Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Snarkiness. If you like what you heard, please consider giving us a share on social media or leaving us a review on your podcasting platform of choice.
If you'd like to reach out to us, you can find us at facebook.com/libertysnark or send us an email at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening.